This is Kate Scott Allen of OGKiller.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded October 17, 2013. Tonight we're going to be talking about Couch and CISODB and MyCouch and all kinds of great stuff, and we're going to learn a lot together. We have on the call Daniel Wertheim and Max Thayer. So I first found out about Daniel from following CISODB, which I thought was kind of an interesting hack. You were basically running a document database on top of SQL Server, is that right?
Yeah, which is kind of a hack, I guess. I mean, it's obviously not NoSQL, but it tries to bring document orientation to SQL Server. So.
And the reason I thought that that would be useful is there are a lot of people working in shops that have a requirement that everything is on SQL Server, right? And so, I mean, this seems like a nice way to say, yeah, this app's running on SQL Server, and then I get to do some cool document database stuff on top of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's why it kind of came to life, because I was working in spots where SQL Server was a requirement and we couldn't have anything else.
Okay.
But if you can, I would suggest go with like a pure NoSQL solution, since scaling and...
Yeah, all those other things. I noticed that there wasn't a huge amount going on with CISODB, and then on email, I think you'd said that there's a little bit of work going on with like some Gen 2 stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, there's one user who's making everything async. I'm not sure what the status is about that, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So then I started talking to you about that, and then you quickly said we should talk about Couch and we should get in touch with Max. So Max, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hey, I'm Max. I work as a developer evangelist at CloudEnd and otherwise hack on CouchDB and Node.js for the most part.
All right. And cool. And Daniel, I guess I didn't give you a chance to introduce yourself really either. So other than CISODB, what are you up to?
What am I? I'm a consultant. And I'm also employed right now as a front-end dev, so yeah.
Cool. Okay, so let's move over to talking. I guess let's just jump right in. What does CloudEnt do?
CloudEnt is a database as a service. It's a hosted managed database based on top of technologies like CouchDB. So it's a NoSQL document store that you access over HTTP. So when you sign up with CloudEnt, we give you a URL to hit, and then that's how you interact with your database is over HTTP. And we're now exploring a lot of concepts like one of the really cool core parts of CouchDB and CloudEnt is multi-master replication. So the nodes of CouchDB or different like CloudEnt accounts, different CloudEnt databases can sync with each other or share documents. But that replication is really just a protocol. So you can actually treat lots of different stuff as an instance that you can replicate between. So there's a library called PouchDB that basically treats the browser as a CouchDB instance that you can replicate with. I'm working on a project right now called Quilter that treats your file system or parts of it as a CouchDB instance that you can replicate with. And then we've got work going on the mobile end that will treat your phone as an instance that you can replicate with. The idea being that you can share data and move data wherever it needs to go. So that might mean getting your data closer to your users, but it could also be replicating data between data centers so that if Godzilla takes out, say, the East Coast, that your data center on the West Coast still functions.
Okay, wait. I misheard or you blew my mind. You said it could replicate to your phone?
Yeah.
How does that? So I've got CouchDB running, an instance of CouchDB running on my phone then, like a local server?
Sort of. Not precisely CouchDB. The protocol is separate from the technology. So actually our team is implementing that protocol on top of the SQLite technology that you'll find inside of Android and iPhone, and then making sure that that matches up with the replication spec so that they can communicate appropriately and then still continue to hold data on the phone.
Okay. So a few things that jump to mind right away that kind of get me worried or whatever about, you know, cloud and CouchDB and all this stuff is like, what's the latency like if I'm, you know, working with data store as a service? Like that's something I'd be worried about if my web server or my application server is making HTTP calls over the internet to get to the data.
Right. So something that we've actually had a lot of success with is getting the data closer to the user. So there's stuff that you can do at the app level to like preload or bootstrap data so that it's there and cached when you need it. But also, if your data center is just literally close to the user physically, that also has a huge impact. We had one person whose app server was like physically very, very close to the database server, and he was reporting just like insanely low latencies. So as a result, you can do multi-homed accounts that then whenever a request comes in, it sort of geolocates this, the closest data center to work with, and then uses that in order to minimize latency. But then there's also a lot of stuff that you can do with the app layer to cache data, to minimize that interaction time, like make sure that you have your data when you need it. So we haven't really seen latency be a tremendous problem, especially with the way that CouchDB and Cloudant do queries. All of them are pre-computed using indexes. So the time to get a query is always logarithmic, which is really nice.
Okay.
Now, I would agree on the replication is also one thing you could use, I guess, on bringing data more local if you're really, if that's an issue for you. And as Max says, like, not hitting the database, I guess, is the best performance, right? Like the best way of preventing bad performance. So bring in front-end caching, which is something I'm looking at in my couch in the future. So you should easily be able to hook in a front-end cache, which could be like, I don't know, Memcache, Redis, or whatever. And then you can use like changes API in CouchDB to invalidate the cache.
So over the years, you know, there have been a lot of attempts at replication sort of based systems. But what is it that's different about how CouchDB solves this problem versus other platforms? What makes it sort of uniquely good at it, I guess?
So what comes to mind is the way that CouchDB and Cloudant do multi-version concurrency control, so that it keeps revision trees of all the changes made to documents in the database. I mean, this lets us run a lockless system, but also when you're replicating between nodes, if the nodes conflict about what documents they have, then you actually keep all of the conflicts. It'll decide on like which is the authoritative document, but you can go in later and say, hey, like what's gone wrong, what's missing. I'll admit I'm not terribly well versed on the history of replication. Like I'm really diving into how databases work, but I'm not a native to this land.
But you have to correct me here if I'm wrong, but it's using like consistent hashing, right, and multi-version concurrency control tokens to, and makes use of vector clocks, which is kind of nicely described in the Dynamo paper for people who likes to read up.
Can you give us the layman definitions of those terms you just used?
programmer. Well, term. Max can help me out here, but like if I say something wrong, but like consistent hashing and vector clocks would be hashing the key to know on which node document belongs and in what sequence, like what version the document has in each node. So that when there is like a conflict detection, it can see what like part of the tree, I guess you can say, it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Max.
Yep. So yeah, every time you update a document, it's attached a revision number identifying like what layer of the tree it exists at, along with the hash of the document. So that if you try to put a document update whose revision number doesn't match, then the database will return, hey, that doesn't match up with the revision tree. Try again. During replication, it will take that conflicting document and keep it and just report it later and be like, hey, there was a conflict. Like, how do you want us to resolve this?
Yeah.
But it'll never throw away your data.
Yeah, exactly. So it will pick a winner. And in that document with the conflict, it also stores the conflicted version, which you can pull and correct. And one thing I think is nice with Cloudant is it actually brings clustering to CouchDB. And I also think it's awesome that you are in the process of committing back, right, to CouchDB, to the community.
Yeah.
A bunch of stuff of these, like, clustering features.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're committing back. Two major things coming soon. One is that clustering, like, CouchDB is currently a single instance kind of thing. Like, you set up a node, and it just hangs out. And there's no way out of the box to start scaling it. You can kind of set up ad hoc clusters by having nodes replicate between each other, but there's not an out-of-the-box clustering solution. So that's part of one of the first things that we built at Cloudant, and now we're committing it back to the CouchDB project so that coming soon, you'll be able to scale CouchDB through clustering out of the box. The other thing that we're committing back is a new administrative interface called Photon, the current administrative interface for CouchDB, which lets you manage your documents and queries and all that kind of stuff, is called Futon, and we've updated it added some abilities to add things like add-ons and other nifty stuff, and that's also coming soon.
Awesome. So does that mean that Big Couch is like being deprecated?
Yeah, pretty much, because all of what distinguished Big Couch is being merged back into CouchDB.
So for those of us who don't know, what was Big Couch?
Oh, sorry. Big Couch was CouchDB plus clustering, so you could scale it horizontally and have different nodes replicating between each other, sharding data so that they shared load. Basically, Big Couch is born of taking CouchDB, reading the Dynamo paper, and then getting nuts with it so that it optimizes for resisting partitions but remaining extremely available, highly available, as they say.
So let's step back a little bit. Let's say I'm the pointy-headed boss from Dilbert, and I have just heard that CouchDB is cool, and I'm excited about it, and I also know replication's cool. All my data is in SQL Server. What is my kind of road forward to, you know, migrating to a solution that's taking advantage of and, you know, getting my data over into something like cloud? Do you get anything like that, or is it always just kind of greenfield, like brand new stuff?
Oh, we get tons of migration stuff.
Okay, so how does a migration work then?
There are two routes. One is roughly do it yourself, which isn't really hard. You just take your database, you dump it into CSVs or something else, and then we've written a number of utilities like Cloud and Uploader that then take CSVs and upload them to Cloud, converting like tables into document types. So there isn't a proper schema in Cloud or CouchDB, but you can add to each document some sort of type identifier field like type, and then just use that as a programmer to know how to group things by schema. So Cloud Uploader takes these CSVs that you've generated from your tables and uploads them to Cloud. And that's worked out pretty well. Our customers have been pretty happy with that. The alternative is this thing called Weave at Cloud from CloudBees, and that helps you. That actually is a client that you can use to directly move data from a SQL solution like Postgres or Oracle up to Cloud. So if you check out CloudBees and Weave at Cloud, then sign up for an account, then you can do that all through that client, and it's all point and click.
Yeah, and there's a webinar recorded, and links are at your site, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's quite nice, and you see the concept easily.
Mm-hmm.
So a follow-up question on that. Like, I mean, migrating the data in is, I guess, more or less an easy task if you compare it to querying the data, since, I mean, SQL is, you can pretty much query anything if you're a master of joins, but then you have to translate these to views. I mean, that has to be quite a big step for customers.
Yeah, the move from traditional SQL queries to MapReduce is a big learning hurdle. I've had a lot of fun getting people through that. There's one person I've been working with recently around medical data that's coming from a tremendous Oracle solution and that is now getting really, really excited about Node.js and Cloud. And it's been so exciting to see him sort of get MapReduce. But Cloud also has Lucene search indexes that work a little bit more like how you expect SQL queries to work like, where you say, hey, give me every document whose field blah equals other blah. And you can do that at query time rather than at index time. For MapReduce, you write a map and a reduce function, and that runs over every document in your database. The map function transforms your data, like selects, you know, which documents to return and then what parts of them to return. And the reduce function then reduces them into a single value or a single object. And you can then group by different keys and stuff like that to do different manipulations. It's really powerful and really efficient for distributed computing, but it's very different from SQL querying.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds super easy, but I often feel like you read and you hear people about, like, they come from the relational world. They, like, model the data in the same way, and they think they could, like, query it the same way, but at least what I think, you have to start thinking of how you are going to consume your data when you move to a document-oriented world.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, how you can work with embedded documents and not be terribly afraid of duplicating some data in different document types, even if there are like no schema in there.
So I was wondering, I've played a little bit with Mongo in the past, and what I found was that it was important to think about the, like, writing to multiple, writing out multiple documents or writing out things so that they could be indexed. So, you know, like, I didn't have my standard, like, RDBMS indexes that I could count on to query. So I would write out to some index databases as I was writing things out. Is that similar with Couch? Like, you, I mean, I know there's the whole MapReduce side of it, but there's also like writing out documents that are easy to expose to MapReduce, right?
Yeah. So all the queries are written as JavaScript in what are called design documents. Design documents are documents that live in your database. They're just prefixed with the name underscore design and then some particular name that you give them. And that's where you store your queries and your indexes and some other things like list functions, which will allow you to manipulate the output of a query even further. So like if you wanted to output a CSV instead of JSON, you could do that with a list function. And so that's how you manage your queries, which is it sounds like what you're asking about, but correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's pretty much it. My naive impression of like I'd done traditional databases in the past, and then I was like, okay, now I'm gonna just throw a bunch of documents out there and then worry about querying them later. There are these, you know, like there are different functions that you can use to query, but I found that it also helped to construct documents that I could, that were not going to be too hard to query as well, or to store out like additional index things. For instance, like if I wanted to query on time series or something like that, that I might also write out to a time series, I forget what it's called, like a document store additionally.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe I was making something crazy up then.
No worries. The way that you might do that with MapReduce is that you, actually this has come up in the past, where folks will, you know, the typical story of someone who starts up with a Cloud cluster is that they've sort of outgrown their previous solution, which means that they already have a ton of data. So once they actually get that data in, they're like, okay, how do we, you know, now that we don't have schema, how do we manipulate all of these fields to make sure that they're the same, that I can query them? So like say that I have medical data, for example, or clinical trial data, where each clinical trial may have a lot of the same data, but it'll all be, you know, under different fields. Like say gender might sometimes be called sex, or sometimes it might just be called M/F or something else like that. You can normalize all of that data using MapReduce, where during the map function, you can transform that data into consistent forms, and then reduce it down to whatever you need. So you never actually need to, or you rarely need to really manipulate, like play heavily with schema. Just throw your data in, however dirty as it might be, and then MapReduce can sort of make sure that it's pretty when you need it.
Yeah, and the like to pinpoint, the result of the map is what's actually being indexed, right? And it's not like being re-indexing a big chunk every time. It knows when a certain document affected by that index is updated and will like update the index on that. Right, Max?
Precisely, yeah. Unlike, say, Hadoop, which does MapReduce as a batch, CouchDB and Cloudant do it incrementally. So whenever a document is added to the database or whenever a document changes, then we update only that part of the index.
Yeah, so that's an important thing is you mentioned Hadoop and you mentioned CouchDB, of course. And then for MongoDB, which is what I'm a little more familiar with, and I know KScott's used to, and Kevin, you use Mongo also.
Yep.
Okay. So how would you compare Couch, you know, what's the speech on CouchDB for Mongo users?
Oh, yeah. So I used Mongo prior to CouchDB, and I found it to be a good transition from SQL. Like it mapped over to my concept of doing queries in ad hoc fashion, but it started to break down a lot at scale. Like I had to think a lot more about how my installation was running and whatnot in order to make sure that it was performing effectively. Like running queries at runtime over whole terabytes of data is going to be a pain in the ass really, really fast. Because you do all of your indexing, or because you do all of your querying through indexes ahead of time, it forces you to think, CouchDB and Cloudant force you to think about how you're structuring your application ahead of time. And I found that to be much more effective in saving my future selves a lot of design and programmatic pain.
Okay. So if I can I put K-Scott on the spot here a second? Because I know you've been working with medical stuff, and Max has mentioned, you know, medical trial information and stuff like that several times. How does this strike you from the point of view of the work that you've been doing with document databases lately?
Yeah, to me it sounds very interesting because at some point we're going to have a MongoDB database that's going to become a multi-tenant database, and then we're looking at much larger amounts of data. And not sure when that's going to happen exactly. Mongo is working well for us right now. But it is nice to think about JavaScript still being able to use that with CouchDB and something that might work at that scale easier than getting Mongo to work that way. That was my first thought.
Cool. So is that something that you run into regularly then, is the migration from Mongo to Couch?
Yeah, we get people migrating from MongoDB often. We get a lot of people coming from Oracle solutions.
Okay. So in terms of the migration from Mongo to Couch, are there, like you mentioned, things for transitioning from relational systems and that there are kind of systems for doing that. Are there some, you know, pre-built things for saying, okay, move my database over, or, you know, move my system over from Mongo to Couch?
Yeah, actually, when I started at Cloudyn, that was one of the first things that I wrote, was this script for migrating data from Mongo to Cloudyn. And basically what it does is it uses a function inside of Mongo to, or uses one of Mongo's commands to create to dump the database as JSON, and then just kind of formats that and uploads it to Cloudyn. Like, because both systems work in JavaScript, then the transition is pretty easy. Because they're both document stores, like, the concepts are very similar. It's really just the how queries work that's a bit different. A lot of stuff works very differently under the hood. Like, so we mentioned earlier that CouchDB and Cloudyn use MVCC to maintain a lockless system. With Mongo, you have database locks, so that if when you're performing writes, nothing else can write to that database while that write is performing. So as you scale, we've heard a lot of horror stories about that becoming a serious pain in the ass. Sorry, can I say that?
You just did.
Hey.
What is MVCC again? That's
multi-version concurrency control.
Okay. All right. So there are other a few other like database as a service offerings out there. How would you compare what Cloudyn does to some of those?
Yeah. So most of us, most of the database as a service offerings optimize around the same kind of thing, which is that we, when you're a database manager, or if your database goes down, it'll have a serious impact on your system. And like, you're an app developer or you're a business guy, like, you don't want to be getting 3 a.m. calls that'll scare the living hell out of you about things that you don't perfectly understand. Database as a service companies really focus on making sure that you don't get those 3 a.m. calls. We do, but that way your system is always up. There isn't really another system like Cloudyn out there. There are some, you know, databases as services for, Cassandra or MongoDB, but Cloudyn is really the only one of its kind.
I think there is one more, actually. Iris Couch, right?
Right. Iris Couch does.
I think that's based on CouchDB as well.
Yeah, it's CouchDB as a service.
But I'm not sure if they are at all as feature complete as you are. I think, like, as a dev, that's kind of interesting. Like, you can, like, really easily get up and running with CouchDB and, like, start working, right? Even in Windows and .NET world. And then you can, like, make the switch quite seamlessly to Cloudyn because you're, like, what is 98% compatible or something in the API?
Right. Yeah, there's...
So, I mean, and I think I read, like, one story about that, some startup selecting CouchDB just because they knew you guys were there and the migration would be easy. Like, yeah. So I see that as a really big benefit.
Yeah. We've tried to add more and more features to the Cloudyn system in order to make it work better for folks. Like, we added Lucene querying to give people more kind of ad hoc querying abilities so that it feels a little bit more like traditional, like, so that they can map more of their traditional SQL querying experience. But soon we're coming out with native geo-indexing abilities so that you can deal with geodata or, like, mapping data more easily. And then a lot of these things end up getting pushed back to the CouchDB ecosystem because we really, like, we owe so much to that ecosystem. And really, like, because the APIs are mostly consistent, like there are a couple of edge cases where one endpoint may not exist, or like we have features that CouchDB doesn't. But for the most part, I'll hack on stuff locally using CouchDB, and then I'll push it to cloud and no problem.
Hmm. Exactly.
You know, one thing just to back up for a second, you mentioned Cassandra, and that was one that I didn't even think to ask about. How does Cassandra, you know, kind of fit in with all these other, or, you know, specifically with CouchDB, I guess? How would you compare that?
I'll admit to a significant portion of ignorance regarding Cassandra. It sounds like it's based on a lot of the same concepts that inspired Cloudant, like the Dynamo paper, but I don't know a lot.
So on your site, you list a bunch of platform providers. On the front page, you've got IBM SoftLayer, you've got Rackspace, Amazon Web Services, Windows Azure, Joyent, and then a bunch more on the CL Partners page. How does that work then? Is there like kind of integrate? Oh, you've also got AppHarbor. Cool. So is that kind of like a direct integration, like, or, you know, how does that help as opposed to just, you know, I'm working on my own server?
Yeah, so we run, when you spin up a cluster with Cloudant, you pick what service provider and then what data center to put that cluster in, and then we bring it up in that cluster. So the database servers then are separate from your application servers, so you might have an application server running with Rackspace in some data center, and then you can also have your database server in that same data center.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's localized. So then, to make sure I understood that right, you're set up so that you have local cloud instances running in the same data centers as all these providers?
Yep.
Wow. Okay. So that takes away my stupid question earlier about worrying about the latency, right? If I'm calling from an app server and it's in the same data center, there's no issue there.
Right.
Nice.
And you have like two options, right? Multi-tenancy and dedicated as well.
Yeah. So if you want to get started with Cloudant, you can sign up for a free account, and then we'll put you onto multi-tenant instances. And then as your needs increase, then we can move you to a dedicated cluster.
So how do you guys charge?
Oh, so for dedicated clusters, it's per node. And then that'll depend then on which service provider. Say like SoftLayer and Rackspace charge differently, and they run different hardware, and that's then reflected in prices. Multi-tenancy is charged on a per request and per data storage basis. So it's like $1 per gig per month, and then some fraction of a cent per different kind of request. And then migrating from one to the other is seamless. Actually, for that process, we just use replication. Like, we spin up a cluster for you and then replicate your account into it.
So you mentioned a free thing to get started. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay, so how does that work? Like, if I'm listening to the podcast, I think this sounds neat, and I just want to play with it right now, what do I do?
You can go to cloudant.com and sign up for an account, and then we'll spin up, we'll give you your username.cloudant.com, and that's your Cloudant instance that you can start hitting with requests, start putting data to, and then we'll charge you at the end of the month if your usage exceeds $5. So that's like some many thousands of requests and or 5 gigs of storage.
Okay. And you can fit quite a bit in. I mean, I'm assuming like most document databases, it's pretty heavily compressed, right? So 5 gigs is a good amount of data.
Right. There's, as part of our scaling, we shard your data across multiple nodes. So there is some duplication there.
Okay, cool. And like you're saying too, you can develop locally and then push something up as well, right? So like that's not a big deal to do as either if I'm just playing around.
Exactly.
Okay.
I was saying it is like a 5-minute process max to get started. It's really easy. And it's HTTP, so you can like do it with curl or Postman, whatever. And or MyCouch.
Are there wrapper client libraries for all the major platforms, or do generally just people use native HTTP directly?
There are native clients for most languages, because there's a ton of them out there. But we have client libraries for things like Python, Node.js, .NET. Most of these are adapted from the client libraries for CouchDB, like because our APIs are similar/identical, then the client libraries for CouchDB will work for Cloudant. So say you're using .NET, Java, C, anything else that uses HTTP, there's probably a client library for you. And actually to that point, Daniel's been working on one called MyCouch, which is super awesome. Daniel, do you want to talk about MyCouch a little bit?
Well, I can mention something.
Definitely. That was my next question, actually.
I mean, so CouchDB and therefore Cloudant, it's HTTP. So it's kind of easy, I would say, to like make your own lib. But the goal with MyCouch is to be purely async and is to not hide the domain language of CouchDB. So it doesn't try to bring in like nifty repositories or stuff. Like it tries to have an API that says you're working with documents, you're working with bulk requests, you're working with like attachments and so on and so forth. And hopefully I will someday soon get the like Cloudant specific features like search, Lucene and geospatial support in there as well.
So I see it up on GitHub under your account, MyCouch. Is that kind of the main place for people to find out about this?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and there's a NuGet package as well for .NET developers?
Yeah, so it's MyCouch.
Okay. So what's the kind of flow? Let's say I install the NuGet package and then I want to, do
so
something.
So there's like a support .NET 4.5, .NET 4.0, and Windows Store apps. And using the, which is kind of nice, by the way, by Microsoft to provide the portable class libraries as extensions to BCL to provide the async HTTP client. Side note. anyway, so you just new up a client, which is basically you point out an URL to the CouchDB or the Cloudant cluster. And in Cloudant, you would like generate an API key and you would use that for authentication. And then there's like you have subcontext for on the client. So it's like client.documents.get or put or post, etc. So it really tries to keep the verbs from HTTP, etc. Was that answering your question?
Yeah, that makes sense. So as I'm looking through, one thing that seemed interesting, you've got query.configure, and then that configure seems like there's a Fluent interface for constructing a query.
Yeah,
I mean,
you have both ways because it's like a request that is being configured, and the request is turned out in the end as a query string, or in some cases there's a body in there as well because how you pass keys, etc.
Got it. Okay, so I can construct it however I want, or I can go through and use the configure. It seems kind of like a builder or something to configure.
Yeah,
that
for exactly.
Me. Okay.
So it's like you can build your request and you can send it to two different clients pointing to different databases or something.
Okay. And then from what I'd read, like so you were working with CisoDB and then you wanted to migrate one of those solutions to CouchDB, and then that's where you started looking at MyCouch, which then led you to Cloudant. Is that the order?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I have a CisoDB installation that I need to migrate, something that scales more easily. So okay. I've picked up CouchDB because I like the HTTP nature of it. And to learn it, I started to write MyCouch.
Always a good way to learn something, right?
Yeah.
Write a library. Kevin?
Just to go back to something you said earlier, and this may have been a subtlety that I missed before. So is Cloudant a hosted version of CouchDB, or is it like your own implementation of the CouchDB API?
It's a fork of CouchDB. So at this point, it's mostly our own implementation.
Okay. And so if somewhere down the line I'm I'm hosted on Cloudant and I decide I want to bring it in-house and run my own CouchDB server, like what do I give up if I'm going to do that? Or, what am I not getting in regular Couch that Cloudant is giving me, or vice versa, or what kind of pain would I have there?
Right now, the things that you would miss out on, aside from our team managing the database, would be Lucene querying and pretty soon the geo-indexing abilities. But right now, from my perspective as a developer, the big difference is the Lucene queries. However, there are within the CouchDB community, there are add-ons for CouchDB that add things like Lucene querying or like geo-indexing. So you can implement those things locally.
Oh, and like right now, you also will miss the clustering, right?
Right. That seems like a big
feature. You have to like
right,
load balancers and caching in.
Right. We're merging back the ability to cluster into CouchDB, but right now it's a single instance thing, so it basically doesn't scale.
Okay. Let me take a few questions we got from Twitter then. So, and some of these may be repetitive, but that's part of the fun. So we got a question from Data Chomp, who is Rob Sullivan, and he said, how did things like working on SysODB affect the way that Daniel looks at both document databases and RDBMSs?
Wow.
Does anything jump to mind is like after, you know, like, so I'm imagining earlier on you were working with like SQL Server more, right? And then you moved into SysODB, and then does that change?
I would say like the process has made me going like, I don't want to see an ORM anymore. That's one thing, because I really like the way you can work with documents and not having to think about lazy loading and multi-querying and all N plus one and all that stuff. And I also like, I kind of see myself bumping into more and more situations in old systems when you see like common table expressions in T-SQL and really deep joining, and you realize like this person is building a tree. Why not move to something that is structural or hierarchical like from the beginning? So I don't have like a direct answer.
No, that's a really good point, because that's a real pain if you are building a tree structure in SQL Server. And I think most developers run into that at some point and then realize like, oh, this is not easy. whereas like you're saying, if you start with a tree structure, you're set.
Yeah. And also I think it's like one thing more to reflect about as a dev coming from the like kind of often single node RDBMS structure, going to something like distributed as cloudant, like you're not that, how should I say, safe anymore. You will have conflicts. I mean, it's by default, it's eventual consistency, which is something you have to like get to like known to work with, I would say.
I've heard different thoughts on that in the past. Like a lot of what feels like, you know, you're safe because you've got, you know, pessimistic concurrency, it just, I don't know, pushes the problem away. Like you're still going to run into concurrency issues.
Yeah.
It's just where you deal with it.
Exactly. We'll have the lock issues, et cetera.
Okay.
As well in RDBMS. But go ahead.
Well, what are some of the strategies that people use when they're writing couch systems and they have to deal with, you know, these kinds of conflicts? Like you have to deal with it at the application layer now. So how do people handle it?
So CouchDB and Cloudant provide acidity at the document level. So as long as you can wrap all of your transactions into a single document, then you can get ACID properties on those interactions, which then leads to this practice called event sourcing, which is I really like it and I'm really interested in it, where event sourcing, you basically make every interaction into a document because those documents are ACID. Then you can use your MapReduce indexes to reconstruct the current state of an object from all of those interaction documents. So like if I was making a bank, then I would have like account documents that I don't really change much. They might have, you know, immutable information like the account number or stuff like that, things that like change very rarely. And then there's interactions like purchases and transactions and stuff like that. And those are happening all the time. Using a MapReduce index, I could then reconstruct what each account looks like by just matching those documents, like all of those transactions to the relevant accounts in order to understand like what's my current balance and whatnot. This means that all of your transactions are still ACID and that there's very little chance of conflict because you're never updating transactions. Like when you write them, it's a new transaction. You're never like updating an array of transactions or anything like that. So that's one of a couple of different strategies for scaling. And actually what's been really interesting about this is that these are not specific to Couch. These are like event sourcing as a concept from many decades ago. I forget the precise date, but the concepts of like how to scale databases using schema and schema design are pretty well thought out and established. And there's some really interesting writing out there about how to do it effectively that I've been gorging myself on.
Okay. And kind of related, maybe, we had another question from Twitter from Steve Strong, and he asked, what's the offline story to sync a database in a web client? And he hears that's pretty cool. I know you mentioned a little bit about some of those things synchronizing to clients way at the beginning. How does that, is there something for synchronizing to a web client?
Yeah, there's this thing called, it's really exciting. There's this thing called, there's this thing called PouchDB, which treats your browser like a CouchDB instance. So when it starts up, you tell it where to get data from, and so it'll go and try to get data. But in the meantime, you can write to PouchDB and it'll store that data in your browser, say using like local storage. So it'll persist over time and then just sync that data with a remote instance so that like if this is a phone app and you're going through the subway and you lose connection, then PouchDB has all of the data that it's synced, and then any data that you write to it, it will just replicate up to the remote host once it has connection again. But in the meantime, you haven't lost functionality.
Wow, that's wild.
Replication is awesome.
Yeah.
Wow, and was that what you were talking about? Or like, would that work in a mobile browser, or what kind of things do? Where does PouchDB work? It says it works in, I'm looking on the site here, Firefox, Chrome, Opera, IE, and Node.js.
Yeah, so it's a JavaScript library, so it's intended for the browser, but I've seen people use it with things like PhoneGap in order to build mobile applications using PouchDB. Using PouchDB.
This is one of those things where I'm going to like wake up in the middle of the night in 2 days and go, oh, that's what I'd do with that. You know? Wow. It seems like the way that you'd write your database is having a local data store that's then eventually synchronized when you're online. I mean, you can architect things completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we can still use that. We can use that to then treat tons and tons of different things as nodes to replicate between. Because really, like, it's just a communication protocol. Anything that speaks HTTP and responds as expected can replicate.
So does this work to something, I mean, would this scale even to something that's kind of more peer-to-peer, where you have like a mesh of basically everyone is a replication, you know, like every client is replicating?
You are speaking my language. This is actually something that I am like profoundly interested in, because multi-master replication means that now we can start sharing data without a dependency on any kind of central infrastructure. So for example, I could create a distributed social network where like each of us runs our own Twitter or runs our own Pinterest and then is able to share that data in a distributed, resilient social network. The hurdle there has always been that one, distributed computing is hard, and two, hosting software is hard. But using things like replication and CouchDB, we can solve those problems and make it really effortless to escape a lot of technical monopolies.
Now, you still need a few things. You need, like, as we talked about before, you need to manage concurrency issues and you know, any kind of, like, you need to architect your data well, so mm-hmm. it'll scale. And another thing is you need a way for clients to find each other, right? You need some kind of registry or some discovery mechanism.
Right. That's still the hard part that I'm figuring out. But I know that it is solvable. I just haven't gone and like whiteboarded it all out yet. But there's nothing particularly in the way of like a central registry, not a central registry, but like a shared registry, kind of the way that Bitcoin runs its blockchain, where I could store and share and replicate a kind of friends list.
Mm-hmm.
And then share that with friends of mine, where it's like, these are the people in the network, and then these are the people that I'm actually listening to. And then just share that with people throughout the network.
Wow. So is that something, you said this is something you're interested in. This is kind of separate from like your day-to-day work, right? Is this just something you've been playing with or studying? Or?
Yeah, it's something that I've done sort of ad hoc talks about at different conferences. And it's something that a lot of my side projects center around, is the usage of replication and distributed computing to dismantle technical monopolies. So I'm working on this project right now called Quilter that treats your local file system like a replication node so that it can synchronize with remote CouchDB or Cotton instances. And my goal is to give it feature parity with Dropbox so that you can do all that kind of stuff yourself, like especially with regards to recent privacy discussions. The issue of the problem of centralized data infrastructure has come up again and again and again. And using replication, we can defeat those things. So that in theory, this is a solved problem. What remains is actually implementing it. So that's what I do with my spare time.
That's interesting. I was frantically searching around for Quilter, and I just found a lot of links that would teach me the craft of quilting. Is there like a URL people can learn about this, or is anything public yet?
Yeah, there's a GitHub repository that is pre-version 1. I use it locally to sync my image folder online. So it works, you know, reasonably well. The tests pass. But so it's on GitHub at github.com/Garbados/quilter. And then I can share that link with you in chat if that helps.
Sure. And I'll put that in the show notes.
Sweet.
Oh, is it NSA safe?
is anything?
Yeah, right. you can replicate directly to the NSA.
Yeah, the tough part is that just like the tough part of the sort of distributed social networks and whatnot is that someone could replicate in and then have access to, like, know everyone who's on the network in some fashion. Now, you could still protect your data, or you could still protect your data from replicating to only protected targets. So you could still manage those relationships. So, like, the NSA could only see your stuff if you were, like, friends with the NSA, but not if they just, like, came on and wanted to see your data. So you can still protect it using HTTPS encryption.
Cool. Is there an overlap with something like Tor, or is that just complete? I guess that's more at the protocol level, right?
If there is, I haven't really looked into it yet.
Okay. Cool. All right. Well, that was an incredibly interesting tangent. I think we're drawing kind of towards a close. Is there a direction or something interesting that we haven't talked about yet with Cloudant, CouchDB, Daniel, any of the things you're up to? Anything you guys want to jump in on?
Yeah, I have a question. As far as I know, the CouchDB itself was written in Erlang.
Oh, yeah.
And I trust you guys. I mean, since you guys forked it, I assume you're still working on that platform. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, our core team, the core cloud and platform is called DB Core. And so our DB Core team still works in Erlang.
Is that a challenge? I mean, it's not as well-known a language. Do you guys have trouble finding people to work on it?
A little bit. But we find that people coming from languages like Python adapt to it pretty reasonably, where what's really interesting about Erlang is really its driving philosophy. Like, the syntax is kind of funky, but I mean, you can get used to the syntax. It's the driving philosophy that's of particular interest, where it's built around the concept that, like, parts of your program will fail, and you need to handle failure gracefully and be able to deal with that effectively. So it's the community is really rallied around building effective distributed system where those tenets are really core to development. So in building, you actually see Erlang used in a bunch of different database technologies. Like, React is also built in Erlang for similar reasons, and it's worked out well for both of us.
Now, Erlang also has the idea, like, it has an entire, like, not just garbage collection, but it has a whole, like, almost like an OS layer. Is that correct?
I don't know.
I think I'm maybe mixing that up with something else. I probably am. No, actually, I think it does have, but I'm not going to go into it because I. Cool. So then, are you hacking away in Erlang then half the day, or?
I've been trying to learn it. I program mostly in JavaScript.
Okay.
I used to program more in Python, but Node.js really converted me.
I saw this, like, screencast from, I forgot the name, but, like, when you get to the point when it shows the memory footprint of spinning up processes in Erlang, like, the jaw dropped, and, like, you should really learn Erlang.
Yeah.
That is it then. There's a whole kind of, like, a garbage collection and a hosting and process system that's completely, like, most programming languages run on top of the operating system, and they say, I'd like a thread, please, or I'd like this or that. Whereas Erlang, from what I understand, is completely, like, it's essentially like its own VM running its own entire almost operating system then.
Yeah, it's heavily isolated in that way, and it's really interesting. For example, like, you can do message passing over arbitrary protocols. So you can pass native Erlang messages, say, over HTTP, which makes it really effective for distributed systems that need to communicate across vast geographies, like, say, data centers or distributed nodes.
Wow.
It's a really nifty language.
Okay, so from you said you've been working up on it lately. Where do you go to learn about it? Do you crack a book, or is there a website? Or
oh yeah, there's this awesome book called "Learn You Some Erlang for great good. And it's available online, or you can buy it if you like the feel of paper. But it talks about, it's a very down-to-earth book about why, how Erlang works, and the ins and outs of its syntax, like its design decisions. And it has a variety of sections about don't drink the Kool-Aid, where like you might have heard this cool thing about this feature, but like here's how it actually works, and here's why it's not as insane as you may have been led to believe, which I really enjoy those sections.
So I've heard, I mean, a lot of the cases I've heard of people using Erlang have been as integrations, like they've got a complex, you know, back-end system or something, and they're integrating with Erlang. Is the kind of interop story like difficult, or do you know what I mean?
I think so.
Like maybe say I've got a Java app or a .NET app or Python or whatever, and I want to like, I don't want to rewrite the entire thing in Erlang. I just see parts of it that I want to, you know, change over. Is it basically like I'm making, you said you can do arbitrary messages. Is that really kind of the integration strategy?
Not sure. I haven't heard a lot of stories about that. Although I was recently at an Erlang conference in New York, where we heard a lot of really awesome stories about people going from like really sophisticated Java stacks, for example, into very, very simple Erlang stacks, where Erlang has some built-in notions about, say, things like finite state machines or how servers work that were really helpful in building resilient distributed systems.
I do have one more question. It seems like MongoDB gets like a lot of the press in the document database world. And I'm curious, like, I'm curious if you have an opinion as to why that is, and if somebody was looking at these two platforms, like, what would you tell them to say, you know, no, you should really think about Couch over Mongo?
Yeah, so I think that Mongo has really won a marketing victory, where from my perspective as a developer, it feels like they have two things really going for them. One is that their interface is very similar to SQL, where you can do sort of ad hoc queries, just like you could in a SQL system. But also just that they really dominated this term of NoSQL and were really able to effectively capitalize on it as marketers. Like there are a lot of technologies prior to the modern crop of what we think of as NoSQL databases that are NoSQL as we now define it. And there have been for a while, but MongoDB has been like just wildly effective at capitalizing on that concept and popularizing it. We get, as far as people scaling up or people using Mongo and cases that they might want to start exploring CouchDB, there are a lot of things, like that conversation would go particularly depending on how people's needs go. But I find myself having this conversation repeatedly, which is that I'll find articles like build a REST API with MongoDB in only 5 hours. It's like, CouchDB provides a RESTful API out of the box. Like that's how you interact with the database. So I recently gave a talk at a meetup, which was how to build a REST API in one command, in which you just start CouchDB and you're done.
Was it a short talk then?
The rest of it was me nerding out about replication. But as far as scaling, I find that I think that the big difference and sort of the customer stories that we get of people coming from Mongo to CouchDB and Cloudant are that they outscaled Mongo. They found that Mongo started really blocking them as they scaled. Like database locks became a huge problem. The intricacies of replica sets became a huge problem. Leader election became a huge problem during partition events and various intricacies of their Mongo setup relative to their application code. And with things like Dynamo rings and multi-version concurrency control, locks go away, leader election goes away. A lot of those intricacies just fall away so that you can really focus on building your application. And by building your indexes all ahead of time, you spend a little bit more upfront time building, like whiteboarding your application, but that leads to better design in the long term.
Okay, fair enough.
Cool. All right, should we wrap up there then?
Sounds good. This is really fun, guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. This is, I mean, there's a lot of new stuff and a lot to learn and really appreciate your time. So, cool. So, we've got, everything will be in the show notes. We've got, you know, I'll have your Twitter and websites and stuff. And then we've got, as far as places to learn more, there's MyCouch. There is CISODB if you're interested and your mean, IT shop won't let you run on anything other than SQL Server, then that's something to play. That's your shot. And then, of course, Cloudant. And like you were saying, it's pretty easy to spin something up for free and get started. So that's a good thing too, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that's it for this week on Herding Code. So thank you very much, guests and listeners, and we'll catch you again soon.
Thank you.